every way that I've measured it, CVSS is just objectively a terrible predictor of, is this vulnerability going to be exploited? All basically equals random chance, at like a CVS 7 or above. So there's things like that. I think risk analysis is another one. You know, I've had many, many arguments over the years about the validity of even attempting to quantify or measure risk. There's too many unknowns. It's changing all the time. It's a, you know, determined intelligent adversary that's going to change their methods as soon as we do something. And yes, you know, all that is true. However, it doesn't negate the fact that you still have to make a decision.
Welcome to the Cyber Ranch Podcast, recorded under the big blue skies of Texas, where one CISO explores the cybersecurity landscape with the help of friends and experts. Here's your host, Alan Alford, President and CISO at Alan Alford Consulting.
Howdy, y'all, and welcome to the Cyber Ranch Podcast. That is Wade Baker. He's a cybersecurity researcher. He's an entrepreneur. He's a professor. He has done a kind of just a bunch of things in the industry. He is on the board of directors at the FAIR Institute. He has been on the advisory board for RSA Conference. He was at ThreatConnect. He is now the co-founder of the Scientia Institute, which aims to advance cybersecurity knowledge and practice through data-driven research. Wade has joined Drew and I today to talk about, go figure, data-driven cybersecurity. So let's smash through a lot of assumptions and get to the heart of what is really going on. Wade, thank you for coming on down to the ranch.
I'm very glad to come. I almost wore my boots, but I didn't. But I thought about it.
Well, Drew, are you wearing your boots?
I'm not wearing any shoes, if the truth be known.
Hopefully we don't step in anything too deep then.
Yeah, that's right. We have to avoid any kind of landmines or any other spiky traps.
So let's start with Scientia Institute. I guess, Wade, just give us a quick broad strokes overview of what the heck y'all are up to over there. Let's start there.
Always glad to do that. So Scientia Institute is my dream job, just to be flat out honest. The co-founder and I were at Verizon for a while, and I created the data breach investigations report and led that team for another number of years. And my co-founder at Scientia, Jay Jacobs, was the primary data scientist behind that report. And so we loved getting all these wonderful data sets and mining them, trying to learn from them and reporting on our findings. And we just thought, hey, I wonder if we could do this outside of Verizon. And, that really was the impetus for Scientia Institute. We said, yes, let's create a company, see if we can work ourselves out of our day jobs doing this kind of data-driven research. Maybe someone will pay for it. And we've been doing it for 8 years now. So it's worked all right. But to your question, primarily we do either commissioned research or sponsored research. Commissioned usually comes from vendors who bring a data set to us that they collect from whatever product or service they're doing. We analyze the data, help them write a report, generally falls under their thought leadership category. Sponsored research is, you know, we have institutions like CISA has sponsored several pieces of research from us where we look at incidents or losses or things like that. And it kind of falls under their umbrella to drive awareness in the industry.
Cool. So I went to Scientia.com, which is spelled, by the way, folks, Scientia.com /iris, like the part of your eye, which actually stands for Information Risk Insight Study, which, by the way, wins coolest acronym of the day right there for sure. So the iris website, I saw a bunch of different studies. There was one on ransomware. There was a kind of a general iris 2022 report on overall trends. You had a 2020 thing that was kind of a looking back deal. So I guess let's dig in a little bit. Drew, before I start just geeking out on the individual reports, did you have any high-level questions you wanted to ask?
Yeah, well, I think fundamentally, I guess two questions before we geek out on the report. You mentioned that you had done this in Verizon. And Verizon's obviously a large company with a lot of capabilities and is known for putting those towards the DBIR and other things. But like, As we get into this, I'd love to hear your perspective on starting this from a bootstrap, because I think a lot of companies might think that data analysis is out of their reach and requires so much expertise or infrastructure or whatever. And obviously starting a company, you had the expertise, but you didn't necessarily have all the other things that might be needed. So as we're talking through these things, I'd love to hear your perspective on how organizations out there could be more data-driven and how that could make them better.
I love the question. I've never had that one asked before, actually. And I think we'll unpack it, like you said, as we go through, but I'll just be honest and say that I wasn't quite sure whether organizations would pay us to do this kind of research. And even still, it is one of our challenges. I mean, we're not the cheapest third-party independent research firm to work with because we basically have to have expert data scientists and expert security professionals to blend those two to do what we do. And neither one of those are cheap skill pools. So, it's worked and we have found ways to try to reduce, you know, the expense of cracking into a data set, other things like that to try to give people what they want. But yeah, that was definitely a concern and can still be challenging. I mean, we just, for instance, on the vendor side of what we do, you know, it's tough for us to work with a startup, brand new, just because they generally don't have a marketing budget for this kind of thing. We've tried to go and find stuff that we can help them do. But you know, it's a challenge. And then on the, enterprise side, you know, there are some companies that come to us, hey, I like that piece of research. Could you do that for us using our data? And generally that kind of work tends to be in the, you know, larger enterprise market like you would expect, because they generally have big data problems and have the, you know, resources to hire us to do that kind of thing.
So it feels like, from a startup standpoint, like the traditional path of going to the analysts and getting the analyst white paper kind of thing is still probably going to serve them better than the real data exercise with you guys. But it sure feels like, you know, based on, and we're going to get into this in a moment, but just from what I was reading last night, that is so much more valuable than the standard analyst white paper.
I think so. Of course, I'm biased. But you know, when I was at Verizon, it was a real eye opener to me, because I don't have a marketing background and that kind of thing. I have a research background, and I'm kind of I am an academic. I mean, I'm on faculty at Virginia Tech, so I've always had sort of one foot in, one foot out. But I like research, and when we published the first data breach report at Verizon, we published it with a lot of resistance. Like, a lot of the executives didn't want it going out there, because from Verizon's perspective, they thought, oh, if we publish that there's a lot of breaches happening, maybe we get regulated and that's not good for us. And all of this kind of thing. But once it was out there, it was phenomenal. I mean, I remember seeing the marketing metrics for downloads and articles and, you know, blog posts about it. And I mean, it just, especially for the first decade or so, I mean, it just kind of captured the security industry around the time that it was published. And I've always, ever since, I've almost been chasing that, because it's hard to recreate that in today's market. But back then it was fairly unique. But anyway, long story there. But that made me realize that, you know, good research really is the best marketing. I mean, that I came to believe that statement wholeheartedly, and I still think that's the case. I think we work in an industry where people are smart and they can sniff out the difference between marketing BS that is pandering to them, silly white papers that have an obvious or predetermined conclusion, and an effort that is actually trying to learn something from data, share that with the community so that they derive value from it. I mean, sure, a product vendor might be paying for it, but that doesn't undermine the findings. And I mean, we take our job seriously to do rigorous research, true to the data, and share that in the kind of work that we do. So
if I were to analyze my own historical data as a CISO, I would argue that the charts and graphs that I literally stole, cut and pasted straight from the PDF into my PowerPoints, are responsible for probably 10 or 20% of my budget gains over the years.
That's an interesting stat. I like that.
It's true value. It's true value. It's a data-driven story. You go upstairs and you're not just FUD and you're not just waving your hands in the air. You're like, look at these experts from the industry who've analyzed bazillions of these things and look at their data and conclusions, and therefore I need money to buy this new toy. And those arguments work way better than the non-data arguments. They just do.
Yeah. I like to think so.
Yeah, I think so too. Like when you think about the genesis of the IRIS report and some of those early conclusions, you know, what was in there that really opened your eyes? Like what did you see?
IRIS opened your eyes.
I know. And if anyone's gone to the website, every IRIS report has a big giant eyeball of varying types on the cover. So
I'm here to play along with the games.
Yeah, we just jumped whole hog into that metaphor. So you talk about the origin, and I think that's worth touching on because there's a ton of reports in the security industry on lots of different topics. But when we did the original IRIS, Information Risk Insight Study, IRIS 2020, you know, there wasn't a report that really dug into the financial losses associated with security incidents, large scale from historical data, as well as trying to establish probability models and things like that. I mean, you had the Panaman/IBM cost of data breach study, but that's survey driven. And, you know, I'm just going to leave it there. We wanted to do a real historical data-driven analysis on what was out there. So that was the impetus. And the reason we wanted to do it was to prove that it could be done. I mean, because you have a lot of organizations that just flat out don't believe it when you start trying to put numbers on things like how often does an attack of this type happen and how much does it cost? And we wanted to demonstrate that, hey, there's a huge amount of uncertainty. I mean, security incidents cost anywhere from $10,000 to, you know, over $1 billion. And that's a ridiculously wide margin. But once you start establishing a pattern and a distribution and parameters, then you can begin modeling it. Then you can begin making better decisions. And that's the whole point of the entire research series is to analyze this data, put it in the hands of people to make better decisions and manage risk better. And, you know, I'm proud of the track record of IRIS in that regard.
I love that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it also opens doors for people to mimic what you do. You know, you become an example for people to follow in that. Oh, I'll use myself as an example. So you know, I've in the past really struggled with how much does this all matter and conveying that to leadership. And so being able to quantify financially the consequences of breaches, you don't have to just do it on the macro scale that you're playing on. You know, you can start playing at the micro scale of your own company and just look at your own loss history and begin quantifying that. And so, you know, for me, that was a real game changer, just to be able to start sitting down with people and explaining, you know, we're going to talk about these various factors that are going to drive costs of an incident. And we're going to talk about how we've experienced those. And we're going to do our own little micro research. And, you know, just being data driven has really improved the way that we can talk about these things. And I think your study is one of the things that was sort of seminal in that journey for a lot of people.
Cool. Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. I mean, we've generally gotten good feedback on those studies, and they seem, based on download numbers and all that kind of stuff, I mean, seem to have pretty good readership, which is what we're going for. And I hope over the long term that it does tend to change the mindset from, oh, we got to hand wave and make everything up and sort of go with gut feel and do sort of high, medium, low, that kind of stuff too, where we can start applying some numbers and probabilities and those kinds of things to our security decision making.
Yeah, it's interesting to me the types of data you can grab. Like Drew, you're talking about kind of an enterprise perspective to do that micro research with your own data in hand. And I think of certain verticals where this stuff is a no-brainer and is obvious and easy for them. And then there's other places where we have to rely on something like IRIS, right? Like manufacturing. I remember, I'm going to date myself here. Do y'all remember the Melissa virus?
Sure.
Yeah.
I worked at a manufacturing company when that thing hit, and it hit the computers that drove the floor. And the bosses were behind me the whole time I'm trying to recover our entire shop. They're looming over me saying, we are losing $1.5 million an hour. We are losing $1.5 million an hour. We are losing a million. They knew exactly what they were losing. Like manufacturing has that down to an absolute, you know, millisecond science, right? And not everybody has that luxury. And I think carving out the greater data from the greater superset of the greater world, and like you said, it's a bell curve. It's not just a, this is going to cost you $5.7. Like there's a bell curve there. But I think that's invaluable for the folks that don't have that kind of handle on their own monetary flow.
Yeah. And just to, I mean, give an example, spin off your manufacturing example there. I mean, the data that we're working with is historical data. It's based on public disclosures and it's public information. There's nothing in IRIS that is internal to an organization or something that didn't come from public sources somehow. But based on what we know about publicly known security incidents and losses, 80% of known or reported losses from cybersecurity incidents in the manufacturing sector are ransomware. And, you know, and I think that is because ransomware and downtime and disruptions and things like that are felt big time, in that space. Right. And if you look at sort of, we did this events, percentage of events and percentage of losses, and manufacturing is the, you know, the one that's out in the right. And you know, I'm not sure everybody thinks of that because we tend to think healthcare and ransomware or other industries that we have at least heard about in media more. But you know, that's why I love doing this kind of stuff, because I think I didn't know that, or I wouldn't have thought that, and now I know.
And what do you see? You know, when you think about using data, using this analysis to drive decisions and to inform perspectives, you know, there's a lot of people who are still pursuing the hand waving that you alluded to, and still using mental models for pretty much everything, and still using their own history, their own personal anecdotal history, rather than even looking across their own company for data. When you start seeing people becoming more data driven, when you yourself and your research are more embracing this broader set of data, like what's a thing that you've seen where people just resist the truth, or the contrary, you know, something that people should be embracing but they're ignoring? Like, have you seen things like that pop up?
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, I think we have so many different, you know, sacred cows in the security industry that we latch onto and we believe them to be the case. You know, I hate to do it because it's almost too easy to knock over, but let's just take CVSS. You know, has been around forever, long standing, and maybe because it's so long standing, it tends to have a lot of trust. And misuse, you know. But if you, every way that I've measured it, CVSS is just objectively a terrible predictor of, is this vulnerability going to be exploited? All basically equals random chance, and like a CVSS 7 or above. So there's things like that. You know, risk analysis is another one. You know, I've had many, many arguments over the years about the validity of even attempting to quantify or measure risk. There's too many unknowns. It's changing all the time. It's a, you know, determined intelligent adversary that's going to change their methods as soon as we do something. And yes, you know, all that is true. However, it doesn't negate the fact that you still have to make a decision. And are you going to make a better decision by, you know, trying to learn from the past and thoughtfully apply it to the future as best you can, or just winging it, you know? And a lot of people, I when I have this conversation with people, I often, you know, do the whole an anecdote isn't data thing, because, you know, you'd be surprised how many people have very strong opinions on the two experiences that they had in the last 10 years. And that just forms everything that they believe about that topic. And you sort of have to pry that away and say, look, you know, I'm not saying those two experiences were wrong. They just sort of seem to be outliers of what seems to be the norm. And, you know, let's talk about that. So it's not easy, and we all have them, I think.
Yeah. And now for a brief word from our sponsor. Alford & Adams Consulting offers strategic and transformative cybersecurity consulting, fractional CISO and vCISO services. We offer assessments, plans, programs, and anything else you might need to be successful in your cybersecurity journey. We can even help you find good cyber insurers and good partners to help manage the day-to-day. Find out more at alfordandadams.com. That's alfordandadams.com. Thank you. The analogy I always use for that one is just, you know, Consumer Reports, JD Powers. You get these data-driven analyses of this car is more likely to break down in 3 years than this car, and yet you have your brand loyalists, right? Like, I'm going to drive a Chevy no matter what, and the data can be the data. They don't care. My dad had a Chevy truck, and it was great.
Yep.
You know, like, okay, so one Chevy truck was great, therefore ignore all the data. Uh-huh. It's that same mindset, I think.
I've driven a Tacoma for the last, like, 20 years or more. So
I love tacos. I love tacos. My next term I'm going to invent here on the spot is the inflatable cow. You got the sacred cows we're all clinging to, and then the inflatable cows that the second you look at them, they just pop and deflate and turn out to be a load of hot air. And I had Adrian Sinabria on the show, I don't know, probably 2 years ago now. He's done all kinds of roles. Don't know Adrian Sinabria, go look him up. He's awesome. He's been an analyst and a hacker, and he's done all the various things. But in an analyst capacity, he hunted down stuff that we were all passing back and forth as truth. And it turned out to just be utter BS. He found one figure from 1 year of a DBIR that got misquoted out of context and turned into a marketing blurb by this one company that then got cited by like five other companies. Like, we tracked the hot air through the equation, and it was all one misinterpretation turned into, and it was law. It was Bible pounding. It was, but everyone knows blah, blah, blah. And it was completely fabricated. It was just a complete.
Yeah.
I remember, one thing I hear him talk about, which may be what you were mentioning here, is, you know, some extremely large proportion of organizations go out of business.
Yes, that's one of his favorite ones to cite. Yes.
And, you know, it's like he's still on a hunt for this,
right,
for this inflatable cow that,
yes,
that doesn't,
the inflatable
doesn't
sacred
really
cows.
Exist, except for the teeny, 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 teeny small companies, but, you know, no major company.
Yep. Yeah. And the reality is there's such a self-reinforcing echo chamber where you know, hey, this has been cited. I don't want to pick on the cyber job shortage, but it's cited everywhere. It's sourced from one place. And so if you don't trace back to that source of the data, you really aren't getting the truth. You're just getting the echoes. And how do you filter that out? Like when you're doing your research, how do you, because you're using public data, how do you filter out that sort of echo factor?
It's hard. So I said I was going to leave it at that, but since you asked this question, I won't just leave it at that. But let's take the Panamon cost of a data breach study. You know, every year there's a statistic that, you know, a data breach is $300 a record or $179 a record or whatever it is, right? And if you read the IRIS 2020, I mean, we do just a flat out takedown of how wrong that is with lots of, I mean, we visually show it. Like, if that were true, this is what it would look like. Here's what reality looks like. And by the time, in my opinion, by the time you get done reading that, we're right. Like, you should view that statistic as completely worthless. And yet, we did that in 2020, and that report is still going strong as far as I can tell. And I rarely hear anybody say anything about it. I mean, there's this little echo chamber of cyber risk quantification nerds that are like, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff. But everybody else just takes it, quotes it. You know, I'm going to multiply 219 times my 10 million record breach, and there's the cost. And it's just, it's not at all. It's terrible. So some of these are extremely hard to change the perception, even with good data and good research, when, in my opinion, it's been, you know, very strongly, rigorously proven to not be factual. But I mean, you know, the world we live in, that's not terribly surprising,
yeah.
given what we see outside of security and that kind of thing. So.
I think it all stems from this desire to have flat math.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be able to pick up the cup and say the cup weighs a pound and set the cup down and pick it up again and it still weighs a pound and never does my cup change from exactly 1 pound, which is a nice round number I can put on a chart for my CEO, right? And the reality is all of this data story is curves. There's nothing, yep. There's nothing flat at all, right?
I very much agree with that. And yeah, because I've evaluated and seen many, you know, risk formulas or such and so scoring formula for security things. And, you know, they all want to do simple math and discrete values and, you know, easy addition or multiplication. Yeah. And it's way more complicated than that.
Well, imagine a heat map where you didn't have point values. You know, you'd just have a blur of all of your risk register items ranging from green to throbbing purple. And yeah. And that's the reality we live in, but nobody at any level in any field wants that reality. You know, you point out that a security breach can be anything between 10,000 and a billion. And every breach is in that spectrum, and many companies struggle with where to place themselves. Is it closer to the 10,000 or the closer to the billion? And they veer towards the extremes and never in the way that is conservative.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, when there's a lot of uncertainty and when there's fear and doubt, that lends itself to, you know, a conservative estimate is going to be higher, you know, kind of worst case. And, you know, that's understandable. And we've done some things with like what if analyses. Well, what if the impact is 10 times, 100 times larger right. than we're thinking? What does that even change your decision?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. And it's,
yeah,
there are elegant ways to handle high uncertainty if people are willing to explore those.
I think part of the challenge is on the other side of that scale. We do have more flat math. In other words, okay, the fear and the concern and the risk are some ephemeral, you know, Monte Carlo sim result, but yeah. The cost of repairing that is give me exactly $117,370 to buy this tool. You know, like yep. We have flat math on the solution side. We don't have flat math on the problem side. And I think that's part of the tension too, is we're constantly trying to balance those two against one another. And a loss exceedance curve that is met with exactly $137,537, you know, like whatever, like,
yeah,
that's not board ready.
no. And you know, something you mentioned there is, one day, you know, I hope to be able to have good data on the effectiveness of the things that we invest in security. You know, I've never been able to, well, I'll take that back. We've done some studies where we've kind of looked at correlation and other things like that, but you know, we can't say when I do this, I expect an X percent reduction in expected incidents yes. and losses or whatever over a time horizon. We're just not there yet.
Yeah.
And there's lots of reasons for it, but one day I hope we are. And then, you know, once we are, then things might become more simple. Like if we really study it well enough to know, then we can do a best practices, top five list. That's actually driven by data. We can simplify it down.
Yeah. Knock your problem story down by 87% by following these five simple tricks,
actual best practices rather than just common practices. Cause I think today we measure common practices, which goes back to that kind of that cult type thinking. Does Scientia engage with the insurance industry's efforts? Because like they must have good loss data.
I know. I've been pursuing it for years and years and years. We have worked indirectly with some in the reinsurance industry, but and the data set that we use is used in that industry a lot, but have not. I keep wanting to get a really large, long-running set of claims data with reported losses and things like that, just to see, you know, are those numbers different than the things that bubble up in public reports and SEC filings and all of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to see the kinds of stuff that the insurance companies handle that are never publicly reported, right? Is the nature of those incidents different than the other ones that rise to public knowledge? And I got to think they are, but you know, I'm very curious to know how.
So, yeah.
And also I'm always looking for ways to merge control and practice information with results and outcomes like incidents and losses. And the insurance providers are one of the few places where that picture is together, because presumably they do assessments of organizations and know at least something about what those organizations attest to. Maybe they do some active scans and other things, and then they know their loss history and claims and that kind of stuff. And I don't know why we don't see more of that kind of.
I know exactly why. I know exactly why. And it's all about the insurance business model.
Yeah.
So first of all, think low margins is the name of the game. And because of that, essentially treat an insurance company like a bank. The premiums in and the payouts out are almost equal. It's a very slim delta between the two. So they are largely making their money off the interest from the money they sit on. If they can alter the algorithm to the slightest nth degree where they are 0.1% more accurate than they used to be, that is the difference between them and their competitors making it or breaking it in the field. So something as tiny as a point, you know, tenth of a percent of accuracy, that is like their IP that they are never going to share with the world, because now they're making 3.1 instead of 3%. You know, like that's a big deal in the insurance space. It's a big deal.
I get it. I wish that weren't the case, but you know, I would love to see one of them say, oh, well, you know, we won't publish the inner details of our algorithm, but we can at least
share
which controls correlate most strongly with reduction in incidents and losses, you know, something along those lines.
I think the other thing that they would reveal is that not much. In that, right? I mean, because I've heard this from that industry that much of what we do doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Some things we do matter quite a lot, and you can look at your, if you have cyber insurance, you can look at your cyber questionnaire and you could kind of reverse engineer that. You know, they ask a lot about EDR. They ask a lot about authentication, backups and the like. They don't ask a lot about other things. And so if they thought they were effective controls, I think they'd be asking how well you operate them, how exclusively you've put them into play and so forth. So I almost think you can reverse engineer their viewpoint from their applications.
Yep. I went on a hunt. My little company, Jackalope, is our Jackalope Cyber is our little company that we consult to small businesses for. And I wanted to take something like CSF or CIS and reduce it down to something that was more digestible for the small business community. So I said to myself, well, what if we just kind of create a bare bones framework based off cyber insurability? And thus began the journey. And I found requirements from, I think when it was all said and done, like 21 carriers whose requirements were published in at least a semi-accessible way. Like I might've had to fake I was applying for a policy, get their questionnaire. Like sometimes I had to go through a bit of a paywall or a register wall to get it. But I ultimately compiled about 21 carriers worth of crap. And it turned into a superset of, I want to say about 31 total controls. MFA was on everybody's list. You know, certain ones were there for everybody, and then certain ones were outliers. And I now have this framework I built called my cyber insurability framework. I don't know, we're using that.
That's cool. I like the approach. And you know, maybe one day these things will begin to shift. And there's some other places that have that kind of information, but I kind of agree with you that, Drew, that we may not find something that makes us happy. You know, the answer may be, yeah, it really doesn't seem to matter if you have X, Y, and Z or do ABC. What really matters is, I don't know, the, you know, primary color on your website, or, you know, I don't know, something. Yeah, yeah, like
some
that,
some
right?
predictive algorithm from a random variable. Yeah.
Well, it's often that way. So when we think about the value in being data driven, how would you sum that up? You know, not just from you as a researcher, obviously that's imperative, but why based on all your journeys, somewhat on the conversation we've had, you know, in the insights that people can glean from this, like what's the takeaway that would encourage people? And what's the steer you might give them to say, like, here's why you need to be more data driven. Here's why that matters. And here's a couple steps you could take. Obviously, buying and consuming research is one, but like, what could people do at home, kind of thing?
Yeah. So I think the usefulness of data driven research and analysis, whether you consume that or conduct it yourself, is that over time, it pays off. I mean, it is the same principle as why the gambling houses generally make more money than they pay out, right? Because they study the data, they understand the trends, and they bet on, yep, someone's going to win every now and then, and we're going to have a big payout. But over the long run, you make better decisions, and you can build a strategy around it. And I think the same thing applies to organizations, right? If I do a study and make a decision and you just wing it based on what first thought in your mind, you might be right this time and the next time, but chances are you won't continue to be right over the long term. And I think that's one of the main values. And then, of course, there's stuff we just flat out don't know about, and it's better to admit that we don't know it and try to analyze it and understand it than just continue on in ignorance. I realize a lot of people would be okay with the ignorance, but again, we can expose these things. And over time, some of those have happened slowly. You know, I'll just go back to the DBIR. I remember, man, when we first published that report in 2008, there was a furor that we said 80% of the incidents were external threat actors. Like, and I just remember the storm that created in the industry. What? 80% are insiders. Everybody knows this. And people were really hot about that finding. But now, I mean, I hear that every now and then, but I think the industry has come to realize that, all right, yeah, insiders are an issue and we need to manage it. It's a risk. But just between organized criminals and state affiliated and the spammers and scammers, like, that's just objectively larger population of attackers that's going to do something to us, right?
So you serve that sacred cow extra spicy.
and you know, the difference in controls for internal and external threats are very different, so it matters. Yeah. For how we implement defenses.
Sure. 80% of your focus should be where it needs to be, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's pretty yep. straightforward. I guess the last question I've got for you, because we're getting close to wrapping up here, is, you know, this is great stuff, and I highly encourage everyone, again, Scientia.com, Scientia.com/Iris, go there and look at some of these reports. We've kind of covered the how, the why. How do they engage you? Let's imagine somebody listening to this show says, gee, I could use some of this data analysis. Like, how do you, where do we steer them?
So there's a couple different audiences. If you're a vendor listening to this show, mm-hmm. then hit us up and tell us about your data. And we'd love to explore how we could publish a data-driven report that showcases that information and hopefully changes, you know, hearts and minds in the practicing world out there. So that's one use case. The other is, we work with a lot of organizations that are trying to get a handle on, you know, what does my risk profile look like? How do I start measuring things like probability of a security incident and how much they cost an organization like mine, about my size and my sector, and all of those kinds of questions. And, you know, we can do that analysis on behalf of organizations. So again, you know, that just is, reach out to us, info@scientia.com, or you can find plenty of places to grab us on our website. And, you know, we generally sit down and explore what needs doing.
I love it. I love it. Last question. Is it just me, or every time you see Ponemon, do you think Pokemon?
I do. All the time.
The Pokemon Institute is literally how that's filed in my brain.
In fact, we had a Slack channel where it, you know, it's possible that all mentions of Ponemon may have been changed to Pokemon.
Oh, that's awesome. You can do that on people's iPhones as well, right? Substitute a word for a word whenever they're texting. That's I'm gonna start doing that one. Well, listen, Wade, thank you so much. I know Drew is having stability connectivity issues here, so I will say goodbye on his half and my own. Thank you, Wade, for coming on down to the ranch. This was a great conversation.
I've rejoined just in time to say farewell.
Folks, go to scientia.com/iris. Check this stuff out. There's some amazing reports there. I spent a whole day geeking out, and I plan to geek out more. So thanks again, Wade.
Appreciate it.
All right.
Guys, have a good one.
Y'all be good now.